from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, former Stanford President Gerhard Casper will join us to discuss his recent book, The Winds of Freedom. It's a collection of his speeches on the biggest challenges facing higher education. Casper was president of Stanford at a tumultuous time, and the speeches and commentary in his book explore academic freedom, campus diversity, and the role of a research university in society and politics. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Gerhard Casper served as the president of Stanford University from 1992 to 2000, a tumultuous time of battles over affirmative action, multiculturalism, academic freedom, and the role of the university in society. Before coming to Stanford and succeeding Donald Kennedy as Stanford's ninth president, the German-born Gerhard Casper served as a constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago Law School and dean there as well, and then became provost of the University of Chicago. Currently, he serves as senior fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and he recently published a book under the title of the Stanford motto, The Winds of Freedom, subtitled Addressing Challenges to the University, a work made up of seven of the many speeches he delivered at Stanford during his presidency there with extended commentary. And the book also includes a commencement speech that he gave in 2003 at Yale. He joins us for this morning's second hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
First time we realized that we have been together since 1993 when he began at Stanford and I began here and actually addressed the incoming students. I was invited to do that, and you were there, and that was kind of a magical time. And you write about that magical time and the whole time that you spent at Stanford, also a very challenging and difficult time. How are you addressed these days, though? You know, former speakers of the House of Representatives, former senators are still given their title mayors. They still call you president?
Quite a few people do, but I think Gerhard is much more common. You know, in my inaugural speech, I made a joke about the fact that, of course, Stanford students would never address me as president, but as Gerhard. And for somebody who came from Chicago, that was a high degree of informality, I have to say.
Well, that informality served you well, I think. And you write early on about what it means to be a president. I want to talk with you about this. Early on in your book, you say university president is a CEO under very special conditions. Under normal circumstances, a business CEO has both fairly far-reaching policymaking and executive powers. A university president, not much of either. In the contemporary university, as distinguished from earlier times, the president is an authority with limited direct power who nevertheless is accountable or held to be accountable for virtually all activities of and in the institution. And I'm reading between the lines here where you're saying it's probably too much expected, much too much expected of a president of a university.
I think that is absolutely right. The range of responsibilities you have goes all the way from curriculum and teaching and so on to all the usual issues that a big corporation may face. Stanford has an annual budget now of $5 billion. And the complexity of the enterprise is vastly greater than most businesses because we have all these different product lines. And departments can be very small. I don't know what the number of our mathematics faculty now is, but it's probably no more than 30. And so you have all these groups who do different things and indeed have a different ethos one from the other. And you have to try to bring them all together and understand that there is a common purpose. I think there's one other difference between a business CEO and the president of at least an American university, in particular private ones. And that is, I really always thought of my job as that of a trustee. I wasn't just a CEO. I was a trustee who had responsibility for a trust created in perpetuity by the Stanfords in our case, and that had to be preserved for the future, where you could not just worry about the present and see what kind of your bottom lines would be.
You say in your book that as president, we'll talk about your time and we'll talk about your speeches that are collected here as well as your comments about the speeches, but you say that you really wanted to make a difference as president. And there were many things that happened. In fact, Stanford is now the number one university, according to a recent New York Times article, in the country, or it's given that honor.
I don't think Harvard has quite realized it. Harvard hasn't quite realized it.
Harvard hasn't realized it, right? I'm looking at Tina because her son has just started school at Harvard. The realization of what kind of impact you had or what sort of a difference you made as you look back.
Well, when I came in 92, Stanford was going through a very difficult period. It had the so-called indirect cost controversy, a dispute between the federal government and Stanford about accounting for indirect costs, a dispute, by the way, that was eventually resolved very much in Stanford's favor. But, of course, at that time, the media attention tended to be very brutal. But there were also a whole range of other issues. We had just, I was reminded of that, of course, in the last few days, Loma Prieta had happened in 1989, and when I came, we still had a lot of earthquake damage from the Loma Prieta earthquake, and a total bill of about $160 million, which now seems kind of a small amount, but, you know, Memorial Church had been destroyed, and the museum had been destroyed, and so on. So there were those tasks, and then there were a lot of alumni who were very unhappy about some trends at the university. I think Stanford was, of course, very successful, but my view was Stanford was trying to do too many things for too many people.
And plus you had all those government regulations and intrusions that you write about, which became problematic, really.
And by the way, which add a lot to the cost of the university, because we have a compliance apparatus that is as big as anywhere, perhaps bigger, because every time the government gets interested in a particular subject, they tend to pass a regulation affecting the universities. There was that. But I was really believing very strongly that we needed to kind of come back to a focus. And for me, the focus was obvious. It was teaching, learning, and research. Now, of course, in many different areas. And in particular, and that was an area where I actually had agreed with Don Kennedy, undergraduate education. At the time I came to Stanford, in the popular press, there was a lot of criticism that Edwards was called the research universities. The faculty talked about research opportunities and teaching burdens, teaching loads, right? And that, I think, was the wrong attitude. I think it was true, not particularly at Stanford, but certainly at other places also, students had large classrooms and undergraduates had large classrooms, and I wanted to reduce those. And my vision was one that in some way is incredibly simple. I wanted to convey to all students, including undergraduates, including even freshmen, that they were part of a very serious enterprise, the search for knowledge, and that they could be participants in that even in their freshman year. So one of the reforms we undertook and that I introduced
Did
were...
Did you get some of those senior profs and paid them more to teach freshmen?
Quite to the contrary, we tried to make it attractive for them without extra pay to teach freshmen. And the freshman seminars, for instance, were one such opportunities. Lots of senior faculty, including Nobel Prize winners, began to teach 14 students in a seminar.
There were no carrots with extra money?
No, there were no carrots for that. Actually, that you're raising an important question, though. The carrot, I clearly had to do something to persuade departments to take on these additional obligations, like teaching freshman seminars in small groups. But the way I paid for that was not by paying the faculty any extra, but by saying to the department, if you commit yourself to this program, you get an extra position, an extra FTE. That was a form of payment. It worked beautifully, by the way.
That is a payment.
Yeah.
But there's been, you know, ongoing criticism, not only Stanford, but universities in general, that too much emphasis is on research and publication, publish or perish, that teaching has been, in many ways, given shorter shrift and not given the attention that it should be given, and that, you know, when you have the Nobel Prize winners, you can afford to give them maybe one class a year or no classes and so forth. Plus, they're never trained in pedagogy to begin with. I mean, because they're great researchers,
yes,
or because they publish an immense amount, doesn't mean they're going to be great in the classroom or even effective or viable in the classroom. So that's constantly a difficult balancing act, isn't it, for a president to be a leader in that sense?
I think you are absolutely right. Now, first of all, I think we have to keep in mind that we at Stanford, for instance, do not employ a single professor simply for research. You can be as famous as you might, but no professor who does not also do teaching. Now, our teaching loads are lower and better than at San Francisco State or at many other institutions. But the point is, every faculty member, the first point is, every faculty member has to teach. And I think the other thing, Michael, that has really changed in the more than 20 years that I have been out here is teaching is taken much more seriously in evaluating faculty for promotion, for tenure in particular. We look very carefully at the teaching records of faculty. We look at responses both from undergraduates and from graduate students. And while the teaching is not dispositive, and we will still not give tenure to somebody who is simply a good teacher and does nothing else, nevertheless, I think the factor has become much more important in almost all major universities.
Future Agendas, we're talking with Gerhard Casper, former president of Stanford University and author of The Winds of Freedom, Addressing Challenges to the University. He talks about the university in general here, not necessarily just Stanford, and talks certainly about many of the issues that face universities throughout the country and throughout the world. I want to talk to you about academic freedom because that's a major motif in your work. But before I do that, I want to also talk to you about the role again of the president of a university, the public role. You write about your life to some extent in this book, which I know is unusual for you. And a teacher named Ernest Stahl, who was a model for you and a great influence on you, who stood up against the Nazis in the Third Reich and spoke out and went to jail, and someone obviously who you had great admiration for. But then at another point, I found you quoting Robert Maynard Hutchins, former president of the University of Chicago, as doing damage for speaking out on issues. And now, as president, you were a public figure,
right,
and you were expected to speak out. You were criticized for not speaking out, or you were criticized. Yeah. It was sometimes just a lose-lose. You would speak out, and you would be criticized for speaking out.
Yes.
But talk about that. I mean, that's a conundrum, isn't it?
Yes, it is definitely a conundrum. And clearly, if you are the president of a prominent institution, people turn to you at all times and want you to get engaged in anything, any issue, from Bosnia to
And forgive me, sometimes major donors are the ones who are pressing the hardest.
Yes? That may be. And so it becomes very important. And I did have a somewhat a reputation of being particularly austere in that respect. You have to make very clear that as the president of Stanford, I had certainly a mandate to speak out on any issue involving higher education. And I did, as you know. But I did not have a mandate to speak out on political issues. And people were of course, trying to capture me for their purposes. Now, let's go back to Hutchins. Hutchins opposed World War II, entry into World War II, all the way. He was very adamant about it, and he used the pulpit he had been given as president of the University of Chicago to press his agenda. But I'm not the representative of all the incredibly diverse elements and views that are present at the university. I have to give them a chance, to speak out, have to provide the kind of support and so on if they want to be critical. But I myself should not become somebody who is identified with a particular political faction. I could do that before I became president. I can do that after I'm president. But not while I'm president. I believed I had to be really neutral on issues so that I would not be used for somebody's bandwagon.
But what about, for example, when Condoleezza Rice was provost and later on working behind the scenes to engineer the war in Iraq, having certainly a great deal to do with being one of the architects of that war, one could easily argue. Would the president of the university have a responsibility to speak out if he believed and was convinced that the war was wrong?
No, only as I could vote, and I could, of course, privately communicate my views. But I did not believe I had a mandate to speak out against that war. Though, of course, when Condi, who was, by the way, an outstanding provost and who was very careful not to mix politics and academic affairs while she was a provost. But then when she joined the government, she and I just disagreed, and we disagreed sharply. But I did not believe that I had particular standing to use. You see, the difficulty is, if people turn to me as Gerhard Kasper, then I can speak out against the war in Iraq. But they never turned to me because I'm Gerhard Kasper or because of my reputation. They turned to me because I was a president of Stanford. So they wanted Stanford to support a particular cause. And that is, nowadays, is even more difficult because universities are clearly much more diverse than they were at the time Hutchins was president of the University of Chicago. Their student body is very diverse. There are very different causes. You know, I had to deal with a sit-in by Chicano students who wanted Stanford to ban grapes because of the pesticides used, it was
nothing to do with Cesar Chavez and the farm workers.
Yeah, it had to, the Chicano students had obviously aligned themselves, or some Chicano students had aligned themselves with Chavez, and the ban had not yet been undone. The grape ban. As a matter of fact, you know, interesting thing is, in all my Chicago years, when Chavez called for a grape boycott, I love grapes and I boycotted the grapes. I ate no more grapes. But at Stanford, I felt it was so important to get across. If we do everything any particular group of students feels very strongly about, we would in no time whatsoever just become a political mishmash.
Well, you did speak out on affirmative action. This was, of course, something and distinguished between affirmative action and multiculturalism. And what was interesting was I was reading Tom Sowell, who has been associated with Hoover for many years, I guess, came out and said, Gerhard, you're being inconsistent, and you sort of said mea culpa. You know, and, I mean, there's a way maybe you feel in the way you need to be as president that was a divide?
Well, I felt I had a responsibility as president to deal with the issue of affirmative action, address the issue, and do something about it. You know, I came very firmly to the conclusion that we do need people who are in leadership positions, who come from minority backgrounds. We cannot leave that just to the Anglos. And indeed, the events in Ferguson, I think, have shown once again what happens when your entire elite, even in a small town, is just of one race. That must be unacceptable. So I felt very strongly about that. But it is also true that affirmative action in practice does involve lots of judgments that are very questionable. You know, for me, the big point is, take our president. Obama is half white and half black. Fifth Indian.
But identifies as African-American.
But identifies as African-American. And he is called black by people. But by what justification? Why is he not called white? It is only that 50% that is identified. And of course, we pay attention to that in affirmative action. If you are 50% black, then your chances of admission may be strengthened by that. That is, to some extent, a highly questionable basis for making a decision about admissions, right? So Sowell was accused me of wanting it both ways, by on the one hand being in favor of affirmative action and on the other hand saying people should not be admitted by quotas and so on, or by numbers. And I think to some extent he was right. I wanted it both ways. But as I tried to point out, I came to a very clear conclusion, and that was I supported affirmative action. And, of course, that was at a time when, in California, affirmative action was being prohibited for the university, for the public institutions.
Speaking about wanting it both ways, I have to ask you about wanting two very distinct cultures to come together and merge. And I'm talking, of course, about Stanford and University of California. You were pretty strong on that. I got to confess to you, you know, I thought, you know, what are they thinking? I mean, at the time, because I was aware of the fact that we had two such different, divergent kinds of cultures and everything. But I don't mean to put you on the spot here to justify that. But at the time, what was your thinking? That this would just enhance so much? And
yeah, you're talking about the UCSF merger,
yes,
right?
Yeah, UCSF with Stanford's merger.
Yes. Well, the then chancellor of UCSF, Joe Martin, and I had come both to the conclusion that doing it alone would create great difficulties for us, in particular in the areas of residency training. At that time, the federal government was sharply reducing support for medical residencies, wanted everybody to become a general practitioner. The highly specialized disciplines that UCSF and Stanford are training in and educating in were not any longer on a priority list for the federal government. So we were worried about what was happening to all of us, including, of course, the marketplace. And and we both concluded, it turns out it didn't work, but we both concluded that maybe together we could do something better. I also thought that Northern California, or the state of California generally, would greatly benefit from pulling together the resources of Stanford Medicine and UCSF. It did not work for the reason you indicated. You knew it all along in a way, and that is, it turned out the cultures were too different. There was also physical distance, of course.
Well, we are coming up on a break, but we want to continue this discussion. As I said, we'll be talking about a lot of things, including academic freedom, with former President Gerhard Casper. But you can join us, and I, in fact, invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments, we're talking really about many things having to do with universities and, well, the politics and the challenges of not only leadership in universities, but of continuing to keep up some of the glorious standards that particularly a university like Stanford identifies itself with. Again, you can join us, 866-733-6786. Gerhard Casper's book is The Winds of Freedom, Addressing Challenges to the University. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any question or comment right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do welcome your involvement in the program, though, so please feel free to join the conversation. Talking about, all kinds of things, the winds of freedom, what does that mean? Freedom at the university and academic freedom. What does academic freedom mean to you? These are a collection of speeches of the biggest challenges that face higher education that Gerhard Casper delivered during his presidency. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with former Stanford president Gerhard Casper, the former president of Stanford University, now a senior fellow with the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford and author of The Winds of Freedom, Addressing Challenges to the University. We're going to invite you to join us. I know there are many of you who have strong sentiments about, well, the role of a president in a university and what that role ought to encompass. Also about the distribution or the proportion measurement of what kind of attention needs to be given to or placed on emphasis on teaching as opposed to research and production of research. I just had, I should mention, a former student of mine who is pursuing a PhD come to me and talking about, first of all, very difficult. It hits a lot of issues. He happens to be a white male, and his, I think, opportunities have decreased. Very outstanding students, but frankly, there are a lot of universities who are looking for teachers of color or women teachers, which, you know, won't get into the right or wrong of that. It's just a fact. And he realizes that his chances of getting hired have diminished tremendously. But he also said to me, you know, I realized, addressing me as Professor Krasny, I realized, Professor Krasny, if I publish an article, there will maybe be a handful of people who will read that article, but that's my passport or my ticket into academia in terms of even any possibilities that might be open to me. And that's a bit disheartening, too. So we'll hear from listeners, no doubt, on that. But I did want to touch on academic freedom with you, and I said I did, because so much of your book has to do with academic freedom, and you exalt it. I mean, and obviously have great reverence for academic freedom on so many levels. What about when you have teachers who cross lines, though, or professors who cross lines, and students, for that matter, who cross lines? I was thinking about the Bruce Franklin case at Stanford, which some of my listeners are probably familiar with, who was actually expelled, and they took tenure away from him because he was, I guess, a wild-eyed radical, and he was saying things that were transgressive and unacceptable.
Franklin's tenure was taken away because of what he did, not because of what he said. That's very important. Remember, these are the times of the sit-ins, the encouragement to students to occupy buildings. Sometimes they set them on fire. One of my predecessors had his office set on fire at Stanford. And so I think it's very important to distinguish between the speech aspect of the Franklin case
versus the deeds.
Versus the deeds. And the university, as a matter of fact, took the position, the panel that evaluated his case or judged his case, took the position that as far as speech was concerned, Stanford would be completely bound by the whole range of the First Amendment.
Well, you're familiar with this case of a university professor, I think from Virginia Tech, who was hired by University of Illinois, and he had put out some tweets that were very critical of Israel and denouncing, in fact, the Zionist state and all of the harsh language, really. And they essentially pulled the offer, which had been in the works. I guess what I'm getting at here is whether it's, and there is a major distinction, thank you, between speech and deed, but when we talk about speech, sometimes we get into amorphous definitions of what we mean by speech and what academic freedom is in terms of speech.
Well, the Illinois case, I have read the newspapers about it, and I think one of the many ambiguities of that is obviously that there was no final offer to him because it needed the approval of the regents or whatever the board is called at the University of Illinois. So that makes the case a little more difficult. But let me point out that academic freedom should be unlimited. But, of course, academic freedom must mean that you, as Professor Krasny, or I, as Professor Casper, do not exploit the classroom for
our political views?
For our political views and convert people to our political views. Instead, the
it's a
whole
pretty gray area, though.
It is. Oh, believe me, I'm a law professor. I know that perhaps better.
Students are being inculcated because the books that they're reading are for the professor an opportunity to inculcate.
But the ideal has to be a professional presentation of your subject matter, presenting the views with which you do not agree just as much as presenting the side with which you agree. This has to be marked by professionalism. If it becomes just sheer politics, it becomes very problematic. But believe me, first of all, there are faculty all over the country who do not differentiate sharply between their professional obligations and their political views.
Or even grade students on the basis of what their political views
absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely. All of that happens. It also happens that much of the time universities are pretty tolerant and are very reluctant to interfere if, for instance, students come to the administration and complain about a faculty member as being too political. So the line is a fine one, and there is certainly a lot of gray. But on the other hand, I strongly believe we have to endeavor drawing that line all the time.
That's the motto that you have essentially put yourself behind here and did when you were president, the winds of freedom, and they ought to be in every way free. But what about where the students are concerned in that kind of freedom? Susan Blakemore, an atheist and the author of the book The Meme Machine, was talking at Oxford, another great distinguished university, and she was speaking about atheism, and she was saying things that apparently was offending some of the Islamic students or those of the Islamic faith, and they walked out and refused to hear her. I mean,
yeah,
there needs to be, doesn't there, some kind of guidepost for students to be open to all
yes.
kinds of ideas?
I do agree. And the one thing that should be an ironclad rule is that students must never disrupt a lecture by somebody who has been invited by some group at the university and with whose views, like the
like Jean Kirkpatrick at the University of California,
yeah,
Berkeley.
Right.
They wouldn't let her speak.
Yes. I think that should be an absolute no-no. Now, walking out may be different, right? I mean, it depends a little bit on how much, whether you have planned it ahead of time and how much of a disruption and commotion you are causing. But I'm certainly, like, the freedom not to attend the Kirkpatrick's or anybody else's lecture to begin with is an important freedom, except you must not disrupt something that is taking place.
And that should not be tolerated. And in fact, if necessary, the police should be brought in?
Yeah. No, police not. No. I come from...
Disruptions can be very...
Yes, they can be. But, you know, I came from the University of Chicago, and the University of Chicago had a sit-in in the 1960s. It was just after the Democratic Convention and the disasters with Mayor Daley's police. And Edward Levy, who was then the president of the university, he decided under no circumstances would police be brought on campus. And
this is the same Edward Levy who later became Attorney General.
Yes, yeah. Right. I think he became Attorney General in part because of the position he had taken at that time. And we handled it all by discipline. Discipline, of course, can be harsher even than having a short police arrest. But
one other question I need to ask you, well, there are many that come to mind, but we want to bring our listeners into this because we were talking initially about the president's role and the president's role to inspire academic freedom, to be a leader with respect to academic freedom. Doesn't the president's role, quite frankly, candidly, get too bogged down in fundraising? Isn't that a lot of what the president's job is?
Interesting enough, that is what many people assume, but that is simply not the case. I would say, I devoted time to fundraising. I think I was pretty good at it.
You got some pretty good endowments, yeah.
Yes, thank you. But I would say I probably devoted no more than about 25% of my time to what we call somewhat euphemistically development. And of course, you have to understand, it's not just fundraising. I'm not just coming to you to ask you for money, but we have to first figure out whether you might be inclined to give us money. There is a whole issue of alumni relations and so on. So it took about 25%. But just remember all the other things we talked about earlier, legal issues or the medical center. There was a time when I spent, in particular at the time of the merger with UCSF, I spent probably 40% of my time just on the medical center. And all the other educational issues and promotion decisions and so on have to be attended to. You couldn't, if a president wanted to, he could not possibly spend the majority of his time on fundraising.
We'll go to our calls. We'll go to our emails. By the way, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 with former Stanford President Gerhard Casper, author of The Winds of Freedom, Addressing Challenges to the University, or email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just another question that I have to kind of dovetail with that, and then we'll get to our callers, I promise. And that is the line between Silicon Valley and Stanford. I mean, this came up a lot during your tenure as president. It continues to come up. Ken Auletta wrote a famous article about it in The New Yorker.
Yes,
and
right.
Said the line is too thin. Stanford's becoming, you know, sort of too much of a place to create young entrepreneurs and young people in the computer industry and all of that sort of thing. And how do you say on that?
First of all, I too am very nervous about that. Not just Ken Auletta and others. I'm really very nervous about it. But I think we have to realize that all the public attention these days focuses on the handful of kids who might drop out or the handful of kids who have a mega success immediately. The overwhelming number of Stanford undergraduates are still pursuing their academic career. They are trying to work in the public interest. They do a lot of do-good work and are enthusiastic about it. I think the attention, the media attention on the mega successes is obviously creating problems. The reality in everyday life is very different. Having said that, I think it is also true that parents and their children are making different choices about what they should be studying at college than they used to.
At the expense of the humanities and at the expense of the social sciences and
of the
study of things like philosophy. I mean, Michael Roth was on this program, now the president of Wesleyan,
yes.
And he's written a book about how we have to really continue to enrich students with liberal arts and with education that focuses on the humanities and on these disciplines as opposed to neglecting them and saying learn coding or learn entrepreneurship or learn how to be a scientist.
Now, you know, one of the difficulties in universities beginning with Harvard at the turn of to the 20th century is that most of the curriculum has become elective. And I think we can change attitudes only if universities were willing to be more prescriptive, to say you have to meet a first-year humanities requirement for three-quarters of the year, and we determine what we believe you should be exposed to, right? We have to have that willingness, but universities show very little of that inclination, and that is part of our problem. The majors, let me just say, at Stanford now, the five most popular majors are human biology, computer science, biology, engineering, and economics. English comes in seventh place.
Let me go to our online comments. Scott says, you touched on the importance of faculty and researchers teaching in addition to other work. Are there methods in place for providing training for academics who have never taught in a classroom before? I'm currently a student at a large university. I found myself in lectures where, while the teacher may be an expert in the field, they don't understand how to communicate the information in a clear manner. Is this training a possibility? And how do you get esteemed faculty to put aside their pride and learn how to teach?
An excellent question. And yes, there are methods. We have a center for teaching where faculty are encouraged to go if they are
encouraged but not mandated.
They are not mandated, no. Though I think peer pressure can be very important. I think one way students have had a tremendous influence on teaching quality is actually through their own course evaluations. And the message you are just communicating to me that there is a teacher who is incompetent, somewhere that will get to that person too. And then actually, while not mandating, chairs or deans will sometimes take the responsibility and come to me and say, now, Gerhard, you should really do a better job in teaching this course. They could come and can kind of stimulate my interest in better techniques.
They may be able to shame you but or a bad teacher, but tenure protects bad teachers. I mean, let's be quite frank about it.
Yeah,
it does. And it even protects those who are unprofessional in the classroom.
But tenure is not identical with compensation.
Agreed. Get a caller on. Tom, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael and Gerhard. Yeah, my dad was a college professor and he's from Sweden. So I just keep having these flashbacks to my dad. He was an excellent professor at San Jose State, and believed absolutely in academic freedom. you know, our politicians are pretty much, you know, bought by the corporations, donations, and they really don't have freedom of speech anymore. So the only people really should have or do have freedom of speech are college professors and hopefully the students, especially the valedictorians. You know, high schools now are heavily censoring or not even having valedictorians anymore. They just have a funny little speech, you know, by the top, you know, cheerleader or jock or whatever. You know, if a valedictorian had criticized Condoleezza Rice before the you know, trillion-dollar debacle of Iraq War happened, that would have been the most outstanding contribution of Stanford through the whole 21st century. So Stanford really missed the ball, despite their, you know, endowments, their billions of dollars of endowments every year. They failed in academic freedom and stopping major bloodshed. One thing I learned in humanities with Cicero or Cicero said was, you can avoid politics all you want, but politics will not avoid you. And that's what Stanford fell down on. If they had listened to their humanities professors and valedictorians in the wings, they could have saved this country amidst bloodshed in over a million lives in Iraq.
All right, Tom, let me thank you for the call. And the point is taken. And Gerhard Casper, response?
Well, Stanford most certainly was not responsible for the war in Iraq. I would assume that the overwhelming majority of Stanford students and also faculty were opposed to it. We cannot put the blame for major political miscarriages, like I would agree with you, like the Iraq War. We cannot put the blame for that on societal institutions and then punish them accordingly. I think there is simply no relationship, and I should say that because I have done a lot of fundraising, between raising money and political expectations. I have turned down money because I would not accept political expectations that went with it. But mind you, that can also be a gray area, as Michael said about teaching earlier.
Getting a number of questions about money. Ben writes, if Stanford runs on billions a year, why do students have to pay so much? Patricia says, given California's expanding needs, it is unconscionable that Stanford does not enroll many more undergraduates. We can maybe put those together in a way.
Let me take the last point first. Of course, if we enrolled more undergraduates, and the question is how many more should we enroll, then we would also be increasing our costs. You cannot just increase, if you want to maintain the quality, you cannot just increase the student body without also increasing the faculty, the infrastructure, the library support, and so on. Stanford devotes vast amounts of its resources now to financial aid. In this present budget year, that is about $145 million just for financial aid. And 60% of our students receive financial aid. Not all from us, but the overwhelming portion of that 60% receive their financial aid from us. We still have what we call need-blind admission. We will not pay any attention to a student's financial circumstances at the time of admission to the university. Those are great virtues. They are very, very hard to maintain. We are trying very hard to do that. But there are clearly limits to all of this.
An email from a listener named Kai who says, having been at Stanford when he was appointed president, meaning our guest, Gerhard Casper, I heard the joke that he was elected because he was the only one of the candidates who was able to pronounce the original Stanford motto, because it was in German, but it was actually a Latin motto.
Good for you, Michael.
Give us that pronunciation.
So I can give it to you in both forms.
Please.
The German is, of course, the one that entered Stanford's seal and is Die Luft der Freiheit weht. And I made that joke myself. I said at the press conference where my appointment was announced that the only reason I had been chosen was they finally wanted a president who could pronounce the motto. But I, of course, when I came to Stanford, I had no idea what the motto was. I learned this all on my very first day, the day before the press conference. I then spent some of the night beefing up on the history of this humanist Hutton. And then over the summer, as I prepared my inaugural speech, I discovered to my dismay that David Starr Jordan had made a mistake. He thought it was in German, but in reality, Hutton had written this in Latin, and in Latin it is Videtis illam spirare libertatis auram. And as I said in my inaugural speech, if they hired me just because I could pronounce the motto, no two people in the world can agree on the pronunciation of Latin, and I would be willing to step down immediately again. But they didn't do that.
And here's another caller. Philip, join us. You're on.
Yes, good morning.
Wait a minute. Excuse me, Philip. Tina's saying, let's give a translation of that.
Yes, good point. So the Latin, videtis illam spirare libertatis aurum, is recognize, Hutton said to the clergy assembled at the Diet of Worms, recognize that the wind of freedom is blowing. And that became then the short form, die Luft der Freiheit weht.
Thank you, Tina. And go ahead, Philip. Sorry.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to ask a question about the international students. What proportion of the student body is international students, and are scholarships offered to the international students to bring an international perspective to the campus?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. Obviously, as you are suggesting with the way you concluded your question, it is very important in the global context that our students have exposure to the world outside the United States, not only through acquiring knowledge about it, but also through personal contacts and so on. Now, I think the present percentage of international or foreign students, undergraduate students, is somewhere between 8 and 10% at Stanford. And I think that is similar to some of our competitors. The percentage of graduate students who are foreign students is vastly greater. It is somewhere, I think, around 30%, if not above. And in some departments in the engineering school or so, the foreign graduate student population can be as many as 60%. But, of course, for the daily life of undergraduates, that does not matter tremendously, because while they may interact in seminars with graduate students, they don't socially interact with them. The financial aid issue is a difficult one. As I said earlier, with respect to American students, and that, by the way, means, of course, also the second generation, the kids who are the children of immigrants and who may still be very Indian or Chinese or whatever in their culture. American students, we have need-blind admission. For foreign students, Stanford cannot afford that. And we have raised a substantial amount of money for foreign students just for that purpose. And I found alumni who were interested in supporting that cause. But we do not have enough to have the equivalent of need-blind admission for foreign students. But as I said, we are always working on increasing our financial aid so that we get a better mix.
In fact, here's an email from Rick who says, Professor Casper is a breath of fresh air. If only all university heads had the same fairness doctrine, meaning open exchange of all ideas with none prohibited or demeaned. I heard a discussion on NPR yesterday, including a tearful student deep in educational debt. The problem avoided the big question about the supernormal increase in tuition costs over the last couple of decades. How do universities justify this increase? Also, what are the professors' thoughts about the future with online university courses or as direct competition? I was going to ask you about the MOOCs, but address this listener, Rick.
Well, Rick, increase, tuition increases over the last 20 years above inflation have been 2.5% a year. So tuition increased 2.5% more than the rate of inflation. And there are a number of reasons. One of them is clearly that the consumer price index does not actually reflect the basket of goods a university buys. The university buys, for instance, lots of books, and they tend to be priced quite extravagantly, or journals or whatever. So there is the comparison is not a straight one, but I don't want to hide behind that. I do think one thing that has happened in universities is we are competing in many ways for students, and so we are trying to improve the environment at all times. And if you can get the resources, and some alumni are willing to support that, if you can improve the dorms radically, or if you can create some new facility that is attractive for students, it often will be done. I will say that I would be much more conservative and austere in that respect. When I was president of Stanford, it didn't matter much because we didn't have any money. When I became president, there was a $40 million deficit. The point is well taken, and I wish universities would be a little less competitive in terms of amenities than they have become.
Here's a comment I like from a listener named Andrew. I am foursquare in favor of your guest edict. Someone invited to speak at a university must never be shouted down and disrupted, no matter how awful someone considers their speech to be. The preferred method of showing disapproval is turning one's seat around to turn one's back on the speaker. However, we're in school to learn, and that means to listen. People who use a pose of anger as an excuse not to listen are merely making excuses not to think. We should come to a university to be challenged, not coddled. It's a good place to end.
Agreed, completely, yeah.
And agree with much of what we've heard here. Congratulations on the book and on the years you've served.
I hope your listeners will be motivated to get a copy of my book, of course.
Well, it's out there, The Winds of Freedom, Addressing
Yale
Challenges
Yale
to the University, published by Yale University Press. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening. And senior editor is Don Zoll. Miss him. He'll be back next week. Our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, with production assistance from Vinnie Tong and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.